Good morning and welcome to the Migration Policy Institute. My name is Kathleen Newland and I direct our program on refugee policy and humanitarian response here at MPI, as well as our program on migration and development. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you this morning to this briefing on stranded migrants and to introduce our two distinguished guests, William Lacy Swing and Sam Worthington. I'm afraid I invited you here on slightly false pretenses when I advertised this event as a new challenge to the international community, because it is not new, and I should have known better, because my professional memory certainly stretches back as far as 1991, when after Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, hundreds of thousands of migrant workers left Kuwait, migrant workers from Bangladesh, from Sri Lanka, from the Philippines, from many, many other countries, streamed into Jordan and other neighboring countries and were unable to get any farther. They were stuck, stranded, as we would say now. And the international community had a great deal of difficulty coping with their needs. It was really a heroic effort at the time, not only by the Jordanian Red Cross, but by IOM and many NGOs who had not really anticipated dealing with such a large group on such short notice. But that episode was neither the beginning nor the end of the phenomenon of stranded migrants. And I would have been better off saying that stranded migrants are perhaps a newly visible challenge to the international community, thanks in large part to the revolution in Libya, which left many migrants desperately fleeing the violence and struggling to get as far as the border of a neighboring country, but often, in most cases, able to get no further. We are most fortunate this morning to have here to explain how the international community is approaching the problem today, Ambassador William Lacy Swing. He is Director General of the International Organization for Migration, the 149 member and counting intergovernmental organization that provides services and advice to governments in order to promote humane and orderly migration. I think he's well known to most of the people in this room, but I can never resist recapping his extraordinary career. Prior to his appointment to IOM in 2008, he was twice a special representative of the UN Secretary General, including as head of the UN's largest ever peacekeeping operation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Before that, as a U.S. diplomat, he was six times an ambassador, which may be a record. He has held nine posts that for any ordinary mortal would be seen as the cap of a career, and is nowhere near stopping yet. We are grateful also to Sam Worthington for leading off the discussion after Ambassador Swing's remark. Mr. Worthington is President and CEO of Interaction, which is the nation's leading advocate for international relief and development programs, with more than 190 member organizations. Interaction is really the voice of this country's vibrant relief and development community, and as such helps to shape important humanitarian policy issues and development practice. Mr. Worthington is a constant source of advice to the United Nations and to the U.S. government, both in formal and informal capacities. I think yesterday he was sitting with as a member of the international, the IASC acronym wrong, the Interagency Standing Committee, which brings together the relevant UN agencies as well as IOM, and representative of the NGO community. He also, for example, serves on the Advisory Council for Voluntary Foreign Assistance at USAID and the White House Task Force on Global Development and Poverty, and on many other sort of boards and advisory committees. So I would like now to turn the mic over to Bill Swing. The event is being live streamed today. I'd like to welcome those of you who are joining us online. And there are many, I understand. So thank you for joining us. And Bill, we look forward to your comments.
Thank you very much. I think I'll stand in order to be heard at the in the back. Thank you very much, Kathleen, for your overly generous introduction to me. Thank you very much. And I can't think of two people I'd rather do this event with than you and Sam. Sam and I were together at the meeting yesterday. And Kathleen, we MPI is one of our very close partners. We like to think of you as that. And I'm happy to give that you've given me this opportunity to address just very briefly a very important issue. I think the word new, as I said this morning, I don't consider it a new challenge, but I'm glad you use the word new because it is coming a little more into vogue now. More agencies are dealing with it. It's being looked at now, probably looked at in a high-level dialogue. Special Representative Secretary General for International Migration and Development, Mr. Peter Sutherland, has a new initiative now on stranded migrants, and that's all very good. So I thought it would be, at this time of day, as the weekend approaching, it might be better to keep this a little more lively by doing a PowerPoint presentation. So if I may, I'll stand over here so I can sort of get out of the way. Can we dim the lights a little bit? I wanted to go through just a little bit of, I guess, first thing to say is, it's still a relatively vague and amorphous concept because stranded migrants appear in many forms. I guess the other sort of bottom line point I would make near the end of the presentation is that you don't have to have a new or a revised convention, a charter, or a special mandate to assist stranded migrants. Certainly many of us, IOM and many other organizations, United Nations, UNHCR, all of us have been doing this for a long time. I think the question now is to say, how can we do it more effectively and efficiently? There's not a lot of resources out there for this issue, and very often it's scrambling at the last minute to find the money, the personnel to assist people coming home. So let me start with the next slide. Kathleen and I were joking this morning. I start from a very broad, a global point of view. I want just to situate you where we are with respect to migration. This slide shows that there is a mega trend of large-scale migration in the 21st century. If you add them up, the 214 million international and the 740 million internal migrants, you get nearly a billion. One in every seven persons on the globe in some form of migratory status. Every year I go to China, they give me a new figure. The 200 million figure has now gone up to 230 million Chinese internal migrants, largely moving from the rural and poor provinces of the West to the more Shanghai, Hong Kong, Guangzhou, etc. So the two other trends within that is a large-scale urbanization. That's what the Chinese domestic migration is largely all about. If you remember, 2010 was the first year in which more people were living in cities than in the rural areas. There's also been a feminization of migration. That figure of 50% hasn't really changed very much over the last few years. It was already 1965, 64, was about the same percentage. What has changed is the quality of this, that these are largely, more and more, these are women migrants who are going to follow a career, follow their dreams, etc., rather than just as in the past, women who were going for family reunification. Nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying that it shows a more independent character to the feminine version of migration now. This figure of what we got, 3%, it's roughly 3% of the world's population who are migrating. The figure hasn't changed very much. What it reflects is the large growth in population. You will remember, perhaps, if not, I'll remind you, that the 20th century was the first century in which global population quadrupled. Never happened before. I always say it'll never happen again, but I won't be around to be proved wrong. So, but it's coming primarily from population growth rather than more people themselves migrating. Next one, please. Now, there are six or seven drivers of migration that will ensure that my forecast is correct, that there this will be a mega trend of all of our century. Demography is the obvious one, with an aging North and a youthful South. Demand, the labor shortage is in the North, labor surplus in the South. More and more people are going to appear on your shores or on your doorstep who won't look like you, who won't speak exactly like you, who may have a different culture, different religion, different background. But if they are properly welcomed and given options such as integration, they may very well just share your same values. So, but I don't see a lot of political leadership out there on the question now, saying let's move to welcome these people. In fact, it is the anti-migrant sentiment that is leading very often to stranded migrants. One-entry visas, no visa at all, pushing people more and more into the hands of traffickers and smugglers. The economic disparity North-South obviously is a driver of distance shrinking technology, the digital revolution, 300 million people connected to the Internet in the year 2000, 2 billion today. Anyone with a connection to the Internet knows what's going on at any time, anywhere. The disasters, and this Sam, we spent a lot of time on yesterday talking about how the more and more multiple complex humanitarian disasters are driving people into forced migration. And then, of course, following their dreams. Next slide. I just want to, again, give a little more dramatically these figures. If the international migrants were a country, they would be slightly smaller than Indonesia and slightly larger than Brazil. Their remittances would be slightly less than Saudi Arabia's and slightly more than Austria's or Finland's, just as a few examples. So it is a big, big matter when we talk about migration. Increasing labor demands and gaps. Estimated 40 million workers will be required in Europe by 2050. And we shouldn't forget that China is an aging population also. And so we have stranded migrants, which to date has been a critical and underappreciated issue. And once again, I'm grateful to MPI for this opportunity for us to add a little light to the question. Who are these stranded migrants? No consensus. Legally difficult if you wanted to put it into a document. We use a very practical definition that basically they're vulnerable migrants. They're usually either in transit or at destination, and very often governments are not able to support them. Stranded migrants, who helps them? It is, of course, states who have the primary responsibility to look after their citizens. They may often not have the necessary funds, but often they don't have the necessary presence. And I've recently signed several agreements. Every time I see a government, I say, look, if you have citizens who can't get home, let's sign a memorandum of understanding. Let's agree, whoever stranded from your country, give us a call, and we will bring them home. Now, that's, of course, a big gamble, because if they come in large numbers, I'll suddenly be broke. But I think the important thing is to let them know that help is available. And the reason IOM can offer help is because we are so largely decentralized across the globe. We are in about 440 places right now. I just came back from Indonesia. We have 26 sub-offices there and 50 in Colombia. So normally, no matter how isolated the area, we usually can get to that person and help. I'm not advertising for business. I'm just trying to explain how it is done. And I think that's important that we have that presence there. We are mandated, even if we didn't have a mandate, we do have, because our Constitution calls on us to assist migrants. And the 12-point strategy that was given to us in 2007 by our then 115 member states contains a reference to this. IOM assistance in 2012 was about 12 million migrants. Not all stranded, of course. how do we address the varied needs? We tried to, and actually we put this together for this presentation. Thank you for giving us that opportunity. We put them into three categories. Interrupted migration processes, a precarious legal situation with no documents or otherwise, and then victims of natural disasters and political crises, such as the one, Kathleen, you mentioned, Libya, today Syria, and others. Now, the first category, interrupted migration processes, various examples, those who've either lost their documents or don't have them, never did have them, those for whom the visa requirements were not fulfilled, or who simply run out of money and run into hard times and need a helping hand. Precarious legal situation, of course, there's another very topical category, unaccompanied minors. I think UNICEF calls them unaccompanied children. We stretch it a little bit and call them minors to go a little bit further. Those stranded at sea, regular or irregular, particularly those off of the coast of Somalia, for example, and rejected asylum seekers are those who really need help. And this is a very active category for us. Third category, victims of natural disasters and political crises. We really had our first big experience in 1992, first Gulf War, brought 250,000 Iraqi migrants to safety. Same number, 225,000 in Libya, which we did. This is an operation, a very good example of how agencies work together. We did this together with UNHCR. In fact, I have to give High Commissioner Guterres a lot of credit for this because it was his idea. He called me one Monday morning and said, Bill, neither of us has the resources to do this. Let's do it together. So we called the ambassadors together in Geneva. And to make the point, we said we're leaving immediately after this meeting to fly to Libya. We went down together and worked with our technicians to put the process together. And very quickly, this brought in about $125 million, which we could use. And very, very complicated negotiations between us, UNHCR and IOM, what was left of the Gaddafi regime, the opposition in Benghazi, and NATO. So it was a tricky kind of way to do. We had cruise ships going into Benghazi and Misrata to pick up people. But that's a good example of a political crisis that leads to large-scale stranded migrants. South Sudan, we brought back about 51,000 after independence from Sudan. Yemen, we talked about this morning, a lot of suffering going on here. I was not too long ago in Obok, which is the point of Djibouti that sticks out in furthest into the Red Sea. It's the closest crossing point to Yemen. These are largely Somalis and Ethiopians trying to find a better life by getting to Saudi Arabia or further north, and they get to the border and can't get across. So we have a constant relay bringing them back with Yemeni airlines and Ethiopian airlines to bring them back to Djibouti for further transport home. And this is an ongoing process, the numbers not ceasing at this point. And in Syria, our numbers are very small there, 3,331 to date, because Syria is basically a refugee crisis, and there's not a lot of public or financial support for the stranded migrants inside because they're migrants, not refugees. About 150,000 migrants left inside Syria, about 15,000 who really need to go home urgently, but we've been unable to bring more than this number now, but we'll be continuing. Meanwhile, we're working closely with the various UN agencies, especially HCR, to transport the Syrian refugees from the border to the camps. We've brought back about 275,000. I was up there on the border recently. And when these people, largely women and children, when they get to the border, they're pretty much on their last leg. And being able to transport them from there makes a big difference to get them immediately into shelter, health care, food, et cetera. Now, I'm coming close to the end now, but I just wanted to mention some of the special funds that we have They're all relatively modest. We created something called the Global Assistance Fund, the GAF, established in 2000. It's a very flexible fund that can be used for emergencies. We've given immediate support to about 1,700 through this and 167 already this year. It's a small amount. It's $1 million. We try to replenish it, keep it at full at $1 million. Second one is created more recently, 2006, the so-called HASM, the Humanitarian Assistance Fund for Stranded Migrants. Ad hoc assistance for those who aren't eligible for funding from any other agency or IOM program. A little over 2,000 assisted to date. Again, just about $1 million of funding since it was created. And then a much more ambitious fund, the Migration Emergency Funding Mechanism, which was established by the 149 member states in 2011, designed to help migrants stranded in crisis and large-scale emergencies. I always say it's kind of like your spouse or your best friend comes home and says, look, I've got good news and bad news. Good news is I just opened a bank account for $30 million in your name, but I only put a couple million in. That's the bad news. Well, $30 million has been authorized to go up to $30 million, but competing with other funds, we're only now been able to raise short of $5 million, and we've already spent a good portion of it for Syria. So we will keep working to build that fund up because this will be the major fund for us. IOM, like many other agencies, our problem is cash flow. When you had Libya broke out, we had no money at all in any of our accounts to help. So I guess I shouldn't say this, that we're on mic here, but I basically did something illegal. I went and I took money from another account, which was not legal, because I knew that in about 2 weeks I would have money and I could repay myself, repay the organization. And I knew I could justify that to the member states. What I couldn't justify was the loss of life. Because then the members say, look, Swain, you had money. You have to be more creative. You should have used it. I couldn't justify that. So we used it the other way. And we're hoping that this fund will then keep us legal and keep me out of jail. So that's why we're doing that. Now, the question now is trying to address the gap in a very holistic manner. We've created something called the Migration Crisis Operational Framework because we try to draw lessons from things that we do. We think we owe that to the member states and to migrants. We felt that we did several of our operations only halfway, and I have our former chief of mission in Haiti, and now our chief of mission in Washington here, Luca Dall'Olio, and he can tell you that we thought we did a pretty good job working with all of our UN and NGO partners, in trying to address the problem of 1,000 who died in the Haiti earthquake, the 1.5 million who lost their homes. We got a lot of accolades for that. But at the same time, we dropped the ball. Human trafficking was going on beneath our very eyes. People were flying in with planes, taking children out, thinking the parents were dead, and later found that the parents weren't dead. So a lot of things like that were going on, and we needed to be linked in a more effective manner. Libya got a lot of good press on the question of the 225,000 migrant workers taken back to 54 countries. But the 177,000 that we dropped off in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, 80,000 in Chad, etc., they went back to the same joblessness that drove them there in the first place. There were no more remittances. None of the governments had the capacity to receive these folks back home. There was no schooling capacity or hospital capacity. So, in effect, we solved a problem by creating another one. I'm being very confessional now. Now, the answer to that, in our view, is that we have to have a more collaborative, linked up, comprehensive, long-term manner of approaching these crises, because some other agencies or groups should already have been on the ground ready to receive these people to support the government. We should have been doing capacity building. There was a pre-crisis stage of sensitizing and training we should have been doing. None of that was done. So this new framework is designed to bring us all together well ahead of time. We're doing training around the world now so that we do come at it in a much more effective manner for future crises, of which there are certain to be any number. So life-saving responses, we're doing a lot of regional and global migration management now, training and preparing people for the next crises. Now, this is an initiative that is ready to be announced probably at the end of the year. Until we reach nirvana and have global governance of migration and everything is well agreed to by everyone, which is not yet there, we think we should continue to chip away at aspects of the problem that makes life worse for migrants. One of the worst problems we have are unethical recruitment practices in many parts of the world. We think there's a way to go about that. We want to get the private sector involved. We want to get governments involved. We want to get recruitment agencies involved. We want to agree to a set of principles or a code of conduct that recruitment agencies and countries, governments would sign up to, so that if you're in that program, fine. If you're not in there, you've got to be presumed to be engaging in unethical, corrupt practices. Now, this is not yet ripe for announcement, although I'm announcing it here. It will be announced in full-fledged later in the year, but we think that this will help us a lot because several things are happening. Number one, lots of migrants are mortgaging their lives for the first year that they migrate. They're paying in all of their money the first year back to the recruitment agency. That's not fair. Others are being told they're going to one kind of a job and they end up in another. You're going to work for a nice family. You get there. In fact, you go in to a brothel. These practices need to stop, and I think we'll find a lot of partners in doing this whole thing. So debt bondage, labor trafficking, decreased earnings, violation of human and labor rights, basically what being called now by one of the networks, modern slavery. So we think that there is a way to get at this, and we'll be doing that. And that will help. That will mean fewer stranded migrants. So this is it here, voluntary participation, common code of ethical conduct, a 360-degree partnership, labor migrants, employers, the recruitment industry, and governments. We already have some governments and recruitment agencies already eager to support this process. It'll be called IRIS for the flower. International Recruitment Integrity System. We hope that that'll be catchy enough that people will say that they can remember it and this is something good. So a few policy recommendations on stranded migrants. One is we need to learn to manage migrations in crises much better, more effectively. We have to continue to enhance the evidence and knowledge base because we don't really know how many stranded migrants there are. We want to promote policy coherence and institutional development, link migration, integrate it into development planning, change the public perception of migrants to the point that people recognize that historically migration has been overwhelmingly positive. And then finally, most importantly, perhaps protect the human rights of all migrants. This is what I told you earlier. Someone is actually up to number 470. I said 440. And we're also dealing with all aspects of migration. Conclusion, as I said at the beginning, it's not a new issue. Getting new attention, which is good. No need for a convention or mandate. Experience is important, and right now, IOM's the only agency dealing with the full spectrum of migration with a global footprint, global presence. And we are one of my main, I had three priorities when I came on board. And one of them was partnerships, clear-cut, complementary mandates where we can work together. So I think with that, I probably should take my seat and allow someone else to speak. Sam, I think you're on.
Thank you so much. presentation, which at least in my mind made much more obvious and accessible this sort of problem of what is the problem of stranded migrants. So now I'd like to turn to you, Sam, and ask how your members are sort of encountering this problem of stranded migrants. So many of your members are humanitarian relief organizations. They're right in the middle of these crises. And is this a group that your members have identified as being particularly in need of their attention?
Well, first, thank you, to MPI and to Bill, to the chance to be here, and to all of you for coming out this morning. And I think the NGO community, by definition, tends to focus on the most vulnerable populations in different places. And we do that as part of an international system. We work very closely with host governments, the broader UN system, and try the best we can to fill the cracks that are not addressed by the sort of formal legal systems of the world. The challenge is that the scope of crises around the world has expanded to such a level that to say we make a major difference is simply not true. We barely could touch the surface in certain areas. And you get, when you're focusing on the most vulnerable populations in this case, let's say it's a stranded migrant in Libya, at the war, you're in Benghazi, you're some of the first NGOs in country, and there's a clear message out that, individuals from sub-Saharan Africa are associated with the regime and are associated with your oppressor. You get that translated into an entire population being pushed out, victimized, and so forth. And so that gets to this issue of, who are you working with? The other dimension, of course, is the most vulnerable individuals tend to be women and children. And this gets to this broader issue of protection, which is central to our work. It's all forms of sexual exploitation. It's the broader sense of having both no rights, no resources, no capacity to do something. And I remember working on a program where we were looking with individuals who had migrated from Nepal to Bangalore, again, thinking they were going to the service industry, ending up in brothels, working with NGOs in India, to get them back. And I remember sort of, a cycle of 4,000 women coming back to Nepal and the reintegration and so forth. But how do you cut that cycle? How do you deal with the fact of this exploitation in the villages? So you have the forces of urbanization, which I think have fundamentally changed the nature of NGO work. If you're no longer just out there in rural areas, you're in cities, you're in those slums, which were a transition point for migrants and so forth. And there is this constant increase of global crises that are not resolved at the political level. And so you end up as, one of our, six members working in Damascus. Have been focused on, populations from Iraq and others that have been working in Damascus. And all of a sudden you're in the midst of a humanitarian crisis. You are also then, I won't go into the details, working in the rebel areas. And you're looking at the flows of individuals in that mix, and how many of them are not Syrian and so forth. So I think it really, to me, comes down to this issue of inadequate protections within the global system and inability, to solve, really dramatic political problems. And the scope of these disasters results, at least from an NGO perspective, that you are completely overwhelmed. And no matter how many thousands you are able to provide service with, and everything we do tends to be, you're in partnership with IOM or UNHCR, we tend to reduce it down to, can you help, one woman and her child in a certain circumstance? But then we go back up to the macro numbers and you go, okay, you're responsible for a camp of 500,000 people. And within that camp, you want to create safe legal spaces and Do you have the structures to look at the most vulnerable within that, or you translate it simply to Haiti, you know, working in Cité Soleil, and you have the mass migration from the rural areas, and what happens to the 400,000 people who are still stuck in camps are actually individuals who did not have a home to go to or some place to go to, who are in essence, or I don't want to say permanently stuck, but there is no easy solution that the state is offering. Lack of land, lack of land title, ability to settle. And it, and again, tends to go back to this issue why we focus so much on sort of sexual exploitation and abuse and broader issues around that, is it tends to be largely women and children in the most vulnerable circumstances. So I think NGOs play a key role in this. You know, some of the bigger NGOs are, you know, roughly the size of UN agencies. So these are large entities functioning around the world. Again, in terms of cash flow is a problem. If it's a visible thing happening out there, then the world pays attention. If it's, you're in the DRC and you're looking at movements of population, it's, the world is not paying attention to you. And you know, you find it much more difficult, and then you find yourselves in this constant shortage of resources in the UN system than that the NGO community has in these sort of complex, forgotten crises that unfortunately are generating large-scale numbers of populations that are stranded, particularly when they're across multiple borders.
I wanted to ask if you find in your work and in the work of your members that that mandate is an issue. You know, the one of the ways that the international community has sort of coped with the ocean of need that you've described is by identifying certain populations. You know, we have structures to help refugees. We have documents that sort of lay out structures for helping stateless people, for helping trafficked people, for helping victims of torture or people who are threatened with torture. But a lot of migrants who are stranded, who find themselves just high and dry in a country not their own, don't fall into any of these categories. Is that a problem in terms either of accessing them or providing them with assistance?
I think, yes, it is a broader overall problem by definition, and the need for international structures to be able to give degrees of legal protection and access and so forth. Our challenge is that oftentimes we're working in environments where there are no legal protections, there are no services, there is no one to provide access, and there's nothing to plug into. And so, you know, when you're in that environment, you're looking at populations based on need. And what I think the question really comes down to is, to what extent are you targeting your services at different subpopulations, and are you disaggregating data around that, and are you identifying migrant populations in that work, and who, if they are stranded, where can you help them plug into some legal structure? I think our, you know, the challenge is when you're in an overwhelmed situation where you're helping maybe 1 in 10 of people of involved, you know, there is this bias towards, you know, the question then becomes one of data, of knowing, you know, which populations to focus on and who is the most marginalized, and then can you tie them in? So I think it very much at a macro level, at a country level, there is this need for a mandate. From an NGO operational perspective, the questions of access become one of negotiated access between conflicting parties. And a big conversation we actually had yesterday with Bill and the High Commissioner and HCR was this you know, issue that the space that we have to do this type of work is rapidly closing. And it's closing because you have non-state actors violently intervening, and you have a sense that there isn't sort of the aura of, you know, you're doing a good thing, therefore you are safe and should be protected by the violent parties. And the unfortunate reality is we've seen a marked increase of killings of members of our staff's members, and the ability to function and focus on the most vulnerable populations has decreased as conflicts have become more complex and internal. So the answer is yes, but I'm sort of avoiding the question because unfortunately the populations we work with tend to be those that wouldn't benefit one way or the other, actually, if there was a mandate.
Right, which really does raise the question of the sort of capacity of states. And I know that that's something you talked about, capacity building, Bill. And, you know, we sort of, international law says that states have the obligation to protect their nationals, but in many cases they just don't have the capacity to do that, as you pointed out. A few countries have sort of set about trying to build that capacity. I'm thinking about the Philippines, which after the crisis in Kuwait established a fund that would allow them to repatriate their nationals and so on. But what kind of steps do you think states should think about doing? What would you like them to prioritize?
Well, I'm always a little reluctant to offer states advice and such, but there are a couple of practical suggestions that I think might help, and Sam will have his own perspective on this too. I'd like to hear from him. One is, I think the private sector could play a much larger role in protecting migrants. For example, how many of the private sector companies in Libya actually helped their workers go home? I withdraw the question. There should probably be some kind of an understanding among countries and private sector that in every contract for a migrant worker going abroad, there should be some standard provision that gives the private sector some kind of responsibility for that worker when there's a political crisis such as Libya or there's a natural disaster such as Haiti. But that presently doesn't exist, and the difficult, the clay feet of that suggestion is that it's a competitive world, and if they don't get the workers from, if a country is too exigent on this question, then they might say, okay, we'll go to another country and recruit, which won't be quite so insistent. Now, that's one way to go. The other is, you mentioned the Philippines. Philippines, of course, is probably the country that has the most number of migrant workers relative to the population and the most developed program for protecting them. If you're a Filipino diplomat, I can't think of a higher responsibility you would have than to protect the Filipino population who are in your area. So there, what they are doing, they are now experimenting with insurance schemes so that there is an insurance policy that goes with a worker and is something they can draw on, particularly when they get back. Now, Bangladesh did a very interesting thing in the Libyan crisis. We brought back about 35,000 Bangladesh workers at the government's request, very close collaboration with the authorities in Dhaka. And rather than just dropping these people off and saying welcome home, they went to the World Bank and they got a $40 million, I thought it was a loan, it was a grant. They repaid IOM $12 million for the work we'd done, said use that money and go get more, bring more home, including other nationalities. And for the remaining $28 million, would you please serve as the paymaster and make sure that every Bangladeshi who appeared on an IOM flight manifest gets $750. Well, $750 is not a lot of money, but it's better than nothing. And it allowed people to get, you know, exist for 3 or 4 months, and being as resourceful as the Bangladeshis tend to be, they were able to go out then and start life again. So we need to be, I think, just more creative and more resourceful. It's just a couple of ideas that are there, I think of.
That, very interesting. I want to open this up to all of you for sort of questions and comments. But Sam, if you have any wish list for what you'd like to see governments do, please.
But I do think that it's like most of these challenges can only be addressed when you get three forces coming together, which is governments, private sector, and civil society. And it really does come to what extent are you able, working with different aspects of global capitalism, to you know, we as NGOs are good at this, or blame shame game, but actually become much more sophisticated in working with major corporations of who want to do the right thing, of can you introduce norms within your work? And then but probably more importantly, it's the power of local civil society. And the voice that you get there with governments and the private sector. But I very much agree with Bill that a key element of this is norms within the private sector and getting them to a degree of scale so you're not getting one group saying I could compete better or not. But that this becomes simply a matter, of course, of the way you do business if you were doing business across borders.
I can certainly see that being an important aspect of the IRIS scheme to.
I would simply say, just it occurs to me that in terms of an overarching statement about the problem of stranded migrants, I can think of nothing that would do more to help Interaction, IOM, and the rest of us to do our job better. There's nothing probably more important than trying to get a sea change in the public attitude toward migrants. To try to destroy the stereotypes. Number one, they're coming to take our jobs. Number two, they're going to lower the wage scale because they're prepared to accept lower wages. Number three, there are more criminal elements in that group than there are at home, and no statistic will prove that. Number four, they're bringing disease in the country. You don't give migrants access to your public health service because you love the migrants. You do it in your own interest, because if you have unhealthy migrants, you'll have unhealthy communities. So give them access. I mean, so there's a self-interest in trying to do some of these things. And I was just thinking of the new Italian government. There is a new minister in that government of Congolese origin. And she appeared in a poster that we managed to get into a number of leading Italian newspapers several years ago. She's a doctor, and showed her tending to an Italian who had fallen on the sidewalk and giving him first aid. And the headline was, "And these are the people we want to send home." And it had a very telling effect. And we need more of this. She's now a minister in the new government. But we need to do a lot more to try to educate and inform our publics about who these people really are. And if we'll have fewer stranded then.
So are there questions, comments, observations, please? Would you kindly, because we're live streaming, wait for the mic and then introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is David Savard. I work for IOM, for Ambassador Swing. How do we do that? How do we change public attitudes, public perceptions? How do we change those stereotypes that people have about migrants? You always have good ideas. I'm curious, what's the how do we do these sorts of things?
Yeah, it's good. A key question. I think, well, there are many, of course, there are many possibilities. We're hoping that one result that will come out of the second high-level dialogue of the UN General Assembly on October 3 and 4 will be a commitment to launch a global campaign on the role of migrants and who they actually are, and to try to destroy some of the mythology, to go back to the German theologian Rudolf Bultmann, try to demythologize migration if we can. I think that would be, that kind of a commitment would give you an umbrella under which you could do lots of things then. We do it through trying to market success stories of migrants. I mean, the UNHCR poster, Einstein was a refugee, is a good example of how you do this. But I think there's got to be a lot more of that. There has to be a commitment on the part of governments to engage in some form of public information, public education services, that working hand in glove with civil society, and religious groups and others, to tell people what migration is all about. You also have to try to make an effort to be sure that you try to stem the flow to the extent possible via regular migration, because people think the borders are totally open, then they will think it's not a very credible program. But that also needs to be done in a very intelligent and caring way. I'm sure there are many other ways to do it, but that would be for starters, I think, in terms of public information primarily.
Thank you.
Yes, and I'm Andrea with Refugees International. A couple of questions for you, Ambassador Swing. The first question is regarding this pre-crisis stage you're talking about. To which extent this program is developed? I mean, you mentioned one country in Southeast Asia. Do we have a kind of an idea if, like, 15 countries are ready? Have you got, like, contingency planning? Have you got projection of available for this country, not necessarily to bring people back home, but also do what the what you mentioned, the integration and reinsertion into society. Second question is about the upcoming initiative on unethical recruitment, talking about agents or institution voluntarily acceding to this initiative. Are you thinking down the line to set up kind of a certification process of kind of a monitoring process to basically qualify some of the volunteer institutions being like good employer, good private sector institution, and therefore providing a kind of a visibility and publicity as well? I mean, is there any discussion about certification at the end of the process? Thank you.
On the latter, that's repeat the first question.
The first one was on how much is developed this project of pre-crisis strengthening and capacity building. I mean, you have already contingency planning in place. You have leading countries beyond right. Indonesia. Or...
First of all, on the latter question about the Irish program, yeah, the idea is very much along the lines of your question. There's some kind of a certification process whereby if you've signed up to the program, one has to assume that you're pursuing responsible recruitment policies, and there has to be some kind of a compliance mechanism, spot checks, etc., from time to time to make sure that you didn't just sign up for the program and then go back to your usual business. That's the complicated part of it, and we still have to see how feasible are we biting off more than we can chew? This is what we have to see. And how many do we need more partners in this? This is the other thing. We're all for partnerships. It may well be that we will link up with others who have useful capacity and experience on that. I would hope that by the time of our council at the end of November, we would have a much clearer idea, much firmer prospects for implementing it. But I don't expect that this is going to be ready for implementation and announcement before the early part of 2014. We need a little more time on it. But I think that there's a growing interest in this with governments we're talking to. Some have already said if it goes the way you say you're planning it, you can count on us from the outset. And we'd like when we launch it to have a number of people already who will then endorse it so that there's a bit of momentum built up for it. The training, we're training primarily our own people to begin with. We've had training courses in all of our 9 regions that are either have been done or being done so that we ourselves are ready. I met with European Union in Brussels last week and said that I thought it'd be good to include their EU representatives in countries for the training too if they're interested, and perhaps we could also open it up to NGOs and others as we go along. These are our ideas, of course. It's a 15-step program, and, you know, and all the way from pre-disaster, disaster, post-disaster development. I mean, that's what it's designed to be, and we think it has possibilities, and there's a lot of interest in it. So we'll continue trying to build that capacity to do better than we've done in the past. Because unfortunately, as Sam, as you're saying, I think we're not going to be out of this period of multiple complex humanitarian emergencies for some time.
I think you all have a graphic of the 15-part framework that Bill referred to in the materials that were provided here. Question in the back there.
My name's Elliot, and I come from the private sector with Cisco Systems. And I wanted to know what experience or information you had with just right next door in Tunisia, where we are actually sending American citizens as well as hiring locals as well to, you know, for employment. And it's actually filling up quite fast. And then from what I've heard here in the U.S. that it's going quite well, which is substantially different than next door in Libya. Besides, you know, I can understand from the private sector, you know, an ambassador was murdered. The private sector is probably not going to try to get America or help get anybody out. That's just bad for their business. And I understand that. And that's just like, I think, an outlying that was happened. So that's not the norm. But do you have any information on, like, let's say a company would like to maybe flagship or spearhead that whole recruiting standards and try it out and work with IOM and say, hey, you know, we want to do this right. You know, we want to hire migrants. We want to hire locals. We also want some of our guys from the States who are, you know, of an open mind, maybe even have family that speak the local language. So compared to Tunisia, which seems to be going quite well, what would prevent Libya from getting to that point at some time in the future, if you have any insight into that?
Well, first, I admire your intent and interest. And I think this is, I mean, if we look at sort of, I always look at lessons from different parts of engagement between sort of civil society and the private sector. We've seen this extensively in the environmental area where there's, you know, enormous change of norms and rules because of this dialogue. And I think it really does take a number of companies to sort of lead and try this. I think your question does get to this broader issue is, well, when is it safe to do business risk analysis type thing? And you know, as NGOs, we're obviously involved in risk analysis because you don't want your staff killed. And by definition, 98% of your staff are all local. And at what point is there an economic return to engage in areas? I can't answer that for Syria. I mean, I think things are the world tends to focus on the big stories of, you know, ambassador killed, and the reality may be, you know, a neighborhood and an area where you're working is perfectly stable and you could function. So I think it really has to be at the local level. But it does then come down to this question of, you know, who are you hiring and what are you setting up and what's the intent around that? And the more, you know, and I know one thing about Libya, the Tunisia, very vibrant local civil society, the more they understand what you're doing, the better you've got not only an international link to this, but a local link to this, because you deal with then misperceptions of issues. You may actually be doing something very positive, but local civil society is not involved. So involving them up front to the questions and having them involved in how you're solving these things will result in two things. One, you get actually, you know, better, you know, positive image within the local society, but you're also addressing the issue of safety because then you're seen as a positive actor. So the two things are linked, but I can't answer specifically for Syria.
Yeah, I've simply, only thing I could add, very much along the same lines, Sam, as you answered. I mean, obviously a lot of respect for those who are willing to try to re-engage in a country such as Libya that's still going through its own evolution or revolution. I think that I've taken the position always that the best thing is always to try to stay the course. I'm totally opposed. The very last option ought to be closing an office, closing an embassy, because once you're not there, you're not there. And often very hard to get back in. And certainly once you're out of there, there's very little good that you can do one way or the other. I would have thought the other problem is, I think of Haiti as an example. You know, it's kind of a circular kind of thing. We can't invest because there's no security. Well, there won't be any security until we invest. So how do you then make that decision at that point? And that's where we can't do much in terms of guiding, except to say that we admire those who are willing to try to go in and have a positive impact on an evolving situation.
Thanks very much.
Barbara Krimgold with the Center for Advancing Health. I just noticed in Ambassador Swing's charts that the 2003 to 2013 Afghan and Iraqi migrants, internal and external, were not in the chart. And my question to you, Ambassador, is does the IOM not have responsibility if and while the U.S. military is there? And then after the U.S. military is not there, what is the responsibility of IOM? And also for Sam Worthington, how does interaction and how do the NGOs interact and pick up on that responsibility?
Good question. I'm sure it's an oversight. We have our chief of mission from Iraq here. Michael, you want to stand a second? Michael Pillinger's here. But I can tell you that we are still to this day doing what we can do inside Syria to evacuate and repatriate, to evacuate and resettle what's left of the million Iraqi refugees in and around Damascus. Now, in a normal time, we'd be doing a very heavy numbers of flights out of the Damascus airport, but since it's closed, what we do now is by road, and these are convoys of 40 to 70 on any one day that we do, and we don't do that every day. So we are still evacuating and resettling those Iraqis and are committed to stay the course. This is largely, as you know, a U.S. program run by the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration and State Department. I've been partners for a long time on that. One of our largest offices, both in Iraq and sub-offices, but also one of our largest offices in Kabul. So we're still very heavily engaged, and I don't know why it didn't get in the chart, probably because I gave them a last-minute instruction and they ran out of steam. I don't know. So, but we're still heavily involved. I don't know, Michael, you want to say anything on the Iraq side?
The responsibility is with the government of Iraq. There is a democratically elected government. The concern is, of course, their capacity, and therefore that is what we as IOM, along with other partners, are there for, and hopefully supported sufficiently by the international community in terms of funding. What happens, of course, is we've got the donor fatigue in Iraq in general terms, and our work is becoming increasingly difficult in relation to highlight the plight of the Iraqi returnees or the forgotten IDPs, the forgotten cries of many Iraqis inside the country. When we're faced with such an issue and such a challenge, getting the attention of the media and everybody else in relation to Syria. So it's a sort of balancing act, to one which we remained entirely committed. And in fact, the other issue is you can only resolve it, as Ambassador Swing said, through partnership. No agency is strong enough to deal with the issue alone, and very much so the complementarity between partners is the key issue. One particular, including the private sector and the philanthropic organizations that support the process along. So perhaps I'll leave it at that, if that's okay. Thank you.
So on this point, at sort of three quick points, building on the partnership, in Damascus, the NGOs have been working there. You know, the feeding into the convoys is done by NGOs. So this partnership that we have with IOM is an ongoing and sort of a close one. The second issue is, I remember a meeting with a U.S. ambassador heading to Afghanistan, and we had a number of our members around the table, and we sort of counted just how many staff did that group of 11 NGOs have in Afghanistan. It was 13,000. And so the reality is there's this infrastructure working in complex areas, in all areas of the country, that is national, that is linked to and part of the international NGO network, that will be there before, you know, usually before they were there before, during and after. And then I think that the challenge is as to what degree does that link to sort of formal international structures. And I think the last point is this is back to the unfortunate reality is we move to Syria, so we forget, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq, and then, well, Libya was old. And unfortunately, when it comes to resources, that becomes a reality. And then you forget, you know, then you start, you know, you forget the Americas, you move on from the reality that you've got these real challenging problems worldwide because you've got a global crisis in one country. And that short attention span of the world and the associated resources causes a real.
I think there was a lot of frustration, particularly in Iraq, with the reluctance of the Iraqi government to deploy its own resources to assist refugees and returnees, which, you know, is a difficult one for the international community to deal with.
Thank you. I'm Gustavo Argueta at the Embassy of El Salvador. I would like to ask, we all believe that there has to be, like, as you mentioned, a global education platform, so to change the perception from the people of migrants. But I would like to ask if the IOM is doing anything to re-educate legislators and politicians and policymakers, so in those countries where they still consider or they don't seem to or they still consider migration as a threat to national security policies. I wonder if there is anything done in this
Well, thank you. You put your finger on a very important aspect of the challenge. I mean, I want to introduce a strong element of modesty. I mean, we're a relatively modest institution. That's why we constantly, Sam and I have been talking about it earlier, we're constantly looking for partners because we're one of many players, and all of us together sometimes are not adequate to this global problem of the anti-migrant sentiment that is now fairly well widespread in the world. But your point, if I understand it correctly, is that are we doing anything with the parliaments of the world? Now, that's a very important point because I discovered late in my career the importance of parliaments. I should have known earlier, but it took a couple of incidents in which I had to learn the hard way that it is the parliaments who you dare not neglect. And we need to do more and more. I'm increasingly now talking to parliaments as I go around the world, in addition to the executive branch, and we've got to do a lot more there. Not introducing ourselves into the public debate so much as trying to offer a helping hand and saying, we have the following perspective, what do you think of it, and try to get a reasonable conversation going on it. But changing the global or the widespread mindset about the positive nature of mankind, of migration, as old as humankind, and how it has played out over the years, this is an incredible undertaking, but certainly we cannot afford to neglect the parliaments, even though that's sometimes the most difficult aspect. I mean, and we mustn't just talk to our friends. We need to talk to those who we know have an adversarial view on it. That's where the work gets done. It's all nice to go talk to your friends, but it doesn't produce very much because they're your friends already. So I think that's the tough task we face.
Thank you. Sanjula in the middle here, and then I have a gentleman at the back.
Thank you. My name is Sanjula Weerasinghe, and I work at the Institute for the Study of International Migration. I have a couple of very quick questions. The first one is, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about IOM's experience in trying to assist migrants and other non-citizens who might have been caught in detention, administrative detention, during crises such as Libya, and whether you think it's the role of the government to assist those, and what if the government actually doesn't have a presence in that context? Does IOM assist in some way? And the second question is in relation to the discussion on the private sector and the need to incorporate some type of standard provision in terms of obligations. I was wondering whether IOM's doing any work with John Ruggie and the organisations that have been established to implement the guiding principles on business and human rights, and whether that kind of provision could be incorporated through their work.
Certainly on the latter question, definitely that's a possibility for a further partnership there, and we should look at that and see how we could work together on it. I'll have to myself look into that further. I'm sure some of my people know about it, but I myself would have to acquaint myself first with it and see what the possibilities are there. We would want to find more synergies with the private sector. If I understand, the first question was on migrants in detention. We do work with migrants in detention. We do work to try to get them released, although I have to say here our main partner on this is ICRC. And they are the ones, I think, who have the most credibility on the issue and the most access, partly because of the way in which their whole rules on confidentiality. But we need to do more in that area. We do have we do it largely basically through diplomacy, not through large-scale public condemnations. We generally try to work first behind the scenes with the government to try to get the persons released, and work with other partners who have an interest in the issue.
Come back to the ICRC as a key player here, and back to an earlier point that I made, that the space for this dialogue is closing, is getting tighter around the world, so that the ability of a non-state actor like the ICRC to function is and deal with individuals in detention, depending on the legal environment and the
the degree of the conflict around them and so forth, that their ability to operate it becomes more limited. And so I think this reality, and you know, I know we're sort of focused on international issues here, but I think this, you know, just maybe comment on the earlier bits of, you know, how do you change public opinion and so forth. You know, I commend the article in the Washington Post this morning. There, you know, this ability to get civil society, media, organized groups. There's a lot of talk, of course, by, you know, broader mandates and so forth. But ultimately, from a civil society perspective, societies change by having people organize from a base up and pay attention to different problems. And our ability to do that worldwide is in many ways being constrained by governments who are fearful of that. So this ability to do that, and that closing of space of civil society to influence policy, I think has a direct impact on the question you asked.
I think it's been heartening in the U.S. immigration debate to see finally sort of pro-immigrant voices becoming organized and speaking out as or more effectively than the anti-immigration forces, which have long been sort of well organized and vocal and so on. But it certainly illustrates the point that both of you have made about the importance of sort of grassroots efforts, because there's nothing like political pressure from immigrant origin communities in the political process to focus the minds of politicians.
I might just segue off the question on about migrants in detention to make another point about ways in which you can help stranded migrants. Very often, governments have a policy of deportation. And our position with all of them is say, look, deportation is not the way to go. Generally speaking, if the person, for whatever reason, lack of documents or run up against the local customs or whatever, and needs to leave, therefore, we say, come to us. Let IOM take these people back home for you in dignity. It's a program called Assisted Voluntary Return and Reintegration. First place, they don't get a negative stamp in their passport. They're not badly treated. They come to us. We counsel them and get them ready and take them back. We have an office on the other end ready to receive them. There's a small cash integration package to get life started again. It's far, far superior to deportation. And it's amazing. I mean, I won't want to name countries, but sometimes countries, we say to them, you know, for example, you have a strong interest in a certain part of the world. You really want to start deporting. That's bad for your relations. Let us take them back under this program. For your information, on the average, we do between 35,000 and 40,000 assisted voluntary returns a year, which gets them out of immediate trouble and gives them a chance to get life started again. So there are ways to be creative if you have a more humane and responsible approach to it. So I just segue from your good question.
Thank you. My name is Mamadou Muntaga Gueye, and I was working in the Senegal embassy with my colleague for years. And also, it is a French-speaking country. I know that you have an office in Dakar, Senegal, IOM. I met there because we build a website named diasporaenligne.net. It's diasporaonline.net since 2000. And we are trying always to reach out Senegalese abroad and also African abroad in order to give them more information about migration. And also our goal is how to make sure that we can work out like the diaspora and development, because I was in the head of a mission from World Bank in order to introduce Senegal government in this project. And I don't know if it's working yet, but I'm sure that it was a good project that the diaspora who have experience outside Africa, how we can help them out with the government locally in order to build a project of development that they can come safe back in Africa and contribute to the development and the peaceful way of, you know, improving democracy and stability. Because today everybody knows that in Africa there are some crises like Mali, like Central Africa and else places. But the best way is how to help the African diaspora who have expertise, how to organize them in order to get back to their great jobs, wealth, and good condition of life in order to eliminate all this type of crisis in Africa. Well, we have a website, we try always to, but we have also a lack of assistance and fund in order to go ahead and organize like some type of study locally where we can find ideas and projects that we can have some type of international, you know, organization who can fund those projects in order to make people come back and work hard in their local. Thank you.
You did very well to ask that question because it gives me an opportunity to make an unpaid advertisement. I think, Kathleen and Sammy put his finger on a neglected part of the migration system, which is the diaspora. I showed you on the chart here. It'd be about slightly smaller than Indonesia, slightly larger than Brazil in terms of total number of immigrants there are. These are all diaspora, bringing in about $440 billion a year in remittances, but social remittances as well and other things. So what we discovered, I'm holding in Geneva on the 18th and 19th of June a diaspora ministerial conference to which many countries are being invited, many NGOs. What we discovered was that there is a renewed interest in the diaspora on the part of governments. We've discovered at least 26 governments that have established a special ministry for citizens living abroad.
I think Senegal was the first, in fact.
your ministry has now gone back into foreign affairs as a department, but they're coming to the conference anyway. Now, the idea was let's bring these people together. We have about 50 or 60 governments now who've accepted our invitation, of which about 25 to 30 at ministerial level. And we're not bringing them to Geneva to talk to them. We're bringing them to Geneva to listen to them. We want them to talk among themselves. We want them to share their experiences. What are the lessons we've learned? What are the best practices? What can you learn from one another to try to build a community of interest among themselves, shared interest, try to educate us, and from this to try to produce a monograph or a volume that would become part of one contribution to the UN General Assembly's high-level dialogue in October. We think it's a way to move this whole question forward because we need to think about migration increasingly in terms of human mobility. How do we facilitate human mobility? How do we allow people to keep a foot in several camps? How do you develop a high road scenario? Multiple entry visas, dual citizenships, portable social security schemes, and you can continue on down the line. You have a smorgasbord from which you select a series of options to try to facilitate human mobility, people who legitimately need to get to somewhere else. You have the WTO with the free flow of capital goods and services, but the major element of human mobility is left out. So that's what I think we can increasingly be looking at, all of us. And so the diaspora will be an important part of that high road scenario. Thank you.
To continue with the advertisement, it's an area in which MPI has worked very closely with IOM. We produced a handbook on diaspora engagement, which copies of which are out in the hall there. If you haven't picked one up yet, please have a look, because we tried to construct a sort of roadmap for what the things that government should think about if they want to develop a more productive relationship with their diaspora. And I know IOM is actually helping a number of governments to sort of activate their diaspora engagement policies, including a project in Moldova that I'm working with IOM on now. So a country that has 25% of its population living outside the country, and I think more and more governments are realizing how important it is. Yes, our guest was pointing out the World Bank has a diaspora program as well, and indeed the person who is overseeing that program, Walid Malik, has joined us. I don't know if you would like to make a comment at all, Walid.
Just to continue with the advertisement, I guess. But
we're now in the commercial break.
I think the it's not about the World Bank program. The question is how the World Bank institutions like the World Bank and Immigration Policy Institute, Migration Policy Institute, IOM, and others can help facilitate to set up that bridge between the diaspora and the home countries and the others who want to help. I think that's the challenge. The two things that we are working on is particularly to partner with bigger institutions. For example, the bank program is now focusing on how to support the African Union Commission, for example, as a regional entity in Africa, to help facilitate this as a much more at a transformative level, because it's not one-on-one, but also much more at the regional level. The second thing is the whole issue of gaps in knowledge. And I think we are trying to sort of look for the best knowledge which has already been produced. So idea is not to duplicate, but for example, the handbooks that has been prepared. And the meeting in June perhaps would be a very good knowledge resource for policymakers and government professionals to benefit from. So any of these knowledge products that are available is what we would like to leverage and sort of share much more broadly. So our focus is on these two things.
Thank you very much.
Discuss. Thank you.
We have just come to the end of our time, and I would like to ask you to join me in thanking both Ambassador Swing and Mr. Worthington for a really stimulating and illuminating presentations on both their parts, and invite you to continue to follow this topic through the high-level dialogue at the General Assembly in October and beyond. It's going to be a growth industry, I feel sure. And I know that IOM and Interaction will be right in the middle of that discussion. So thank you very much. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Sam. And thank you all for coming.
For more information on MPI's Migration and Development Program, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/migration_development.